This is edition number 1991 of the Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 31st of October 2025. Hello, you are listening to the Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 30th of October 2025. My name is Sue Jay and my fellow readers are
Tony Escrett,
Francis Doran
and Clive McCombie.
On the notice board today we welcome our new listener Robert Emerson of North Horsham. This week the sun will rise around 6:50 and will set at about 4:30. Thank you for voting with your blue tokens at Tesco's. We expect to hear the results in late November and will keep you informed.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes a spooky study using artificial intelligence, a steamy tale in the present, a moon that ticks and a poem.
But we begin with the main news items, which include plans to change how we hear about alcohol licensing applications, potential council tax increases, inquest at the coroner's court, candidates for Norfolk and Suffolk mayor role, and a halt to a search for a missing person. Let's start with those lead stories.
Alcohol licensing notices are a type of public notice which are used to make local communities aware of plans to sell alcohol in the local area. This could be plans for a new pub or bar, or for a venue to vary the terms of its existing licence, for example, by extending or changing its hours. Currently, alcohol licensing notices must be advertised in local newspapers. This legal requirement ensures that communities are consistently consulted about any proposals to sell alcohol in the area. Often, the notices are also placed on local newspaper websites, ensuring even greater reach and engagement. As a sector, local news media has huge audiences, some 42 million people a month in print and digital. And because the notices flow consistently through local papers, local journalists often use them as leads for stories, seeking reaction to the proposals and comment from local residents. As part of its commitment to public notices, the sector went a step further with the launch of the Public Notice Portal, a digital one-stop shop for all the public notices published in local papers, built with funding and expertise from the Google News Initiative. All this ensures that residents are made aware of plans to sell alcohol in the local community in advance and can have their say. This is what a healthy local democracy looks like. However, Prime Minister Keir Starmer and Business Secretary Peter Carr's plans to axe alcohol licensing notices in England and Wales are placing your right to know at risk. As part of measures aimed at helping the hospitality sector, which is still recovering from the effect of the pandemic, ministers are proposing to remove the statutory requirement to publish alcohol licensing notices in local papers. If taken forward, this would mean that the notices may not see the light of day. A nightclub could open next door and you would be none the wiser until it was too late. This is not a means to reduce red tape. A failure to consult properly could instead substantially increase bureaucracy and the risks of costly litigation. In fact, many licence holders have expressed their concern at the plans. Instead, it is an attack on local democracy which must be resisted at all costs. The government is consulting on these deeply worrying proposals so that there is still time for you to have your say, making clear that you do not support proposals to remove alcohol licensing notices from local papers. Write to your local MP. Trusted local news is in the community for the community, and we will always defend your right to know. The government call for evidence closes at midday on Thursday, the 6th of November. Make your voice heard before the last call on alcohol licensing notices. Owen Meredith says, pubs and papers are both pillars of the local community. They bring people together and facilitate engagement and community cohesion. Ministers say they understand this and want to help both sectors. But the proposal to remove alcohol licensing notices from local papers will do nothing to help either pubs or papers. Instead, it will harm both. Strong local papers underpin healthy, local, democratic engagement, which benefits the whole community, including local businesses, such as hospitality venues. The government is rightly striving for growth and seeking to support both the hospitality and media sectors, but many are braced for more difficult news in the upcoming budget. Axing alcohol licensing notices will not solve any of the problems the government is trying to address. Instead, it will create a whole lot more. This government should stand up for local communities and show support for pubs and papers by keeping these crucial alcohol licensing notices in local papers.
Leaders at Norfolk County Council have come under fire, including from fellow Conservatives, for plans to consult on a council tax rise of more than 5% next year. The Tory-run council needs to make £42 million of further cuts and savings next year and is currently basing its modelling for that on a 3% increase in its share of council tax, including a 1% adult social care precept. But leaders say that the Labour government's assumption is that councils will increase council tax by 5%, the maximum amount allowable without triggering a public referendum. However, in their consultation over the budget, the council also plans to ask people what they think of a council tax rise above 5%, and that has come in for criticism, given the authority is unlikely to go down that route. At a recent council meeting, Conservative Andrew Proctor, former County Hall leader, said, "It's a dilemma, the 3% or 5%. I have to think, what's the point in consulting on more than 5% because we're not going to put it up by more than 5%. Steve Morphew, leader of the Labour group, said, "Residents do like to think you're taking them seriously and asking them questions you know the answer to. Frankly, I think it's a little insulting to them." But Andrew Jameson, the council's deputy leader and cabinet member for finance, said, "I think it's worth consulting on more than 5% because it gives one a feeling that the consultation isn't just a tick. It's an opportunity to have a conversation with residents, as opposed to consult, and get some sense of where they are in terms of understanding the pressures that are brought to bear in local government." Kay Mason-Billig, council leader, said the authority wanted to try to avoid crucifying the public with a 5% increase if it could avoid it. But she said, "Unfortunately, the government are anticipating all councils putting council tax up by 5%. And if we don't, what would the consequences be? Will they turn around and say, you don't need that money? That's the worry, isn't it? But it means it's bad for our taxpayers." Dr. Catherine Rowett, leader of the Green Group, said council tax was a regressive tax and needed reform, but increasing it was preferable to cutting services. All 84 councillors will decide the council's budget and the council tax increase in February next year.
Ivor Stamford died at the Black Boys pub in Aylsham last Sunday. He was 88. An inquest into his death was opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court on Friday, less than a week after the tragedy. During a brief hearing, Area Coroner Joanna Thompson confirmed that Mr. Stamford lived in the town a short walk from the Marketplace pub and hotel. Miss Thompson added that Mr. Stanford had been born in Great Snoring near Fakenham and was a retired section manager. The court heard that a provisional medical cause for his death had been given as asphyxiation due to choking on food. The incident saw emergency services, including paramedics, community first responders and the police, attend the pub shortly after 1 p.m. on Sunday. Mr. Stanford was given emergency treatment but was pronounced dead at the scene. A full inquest into his death will be held on January 7th next year.
Jean Stella Bussey, aged 84, of Woodland Rise, died on April the 19th this year at the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, following an unwitnessed fall 2 days earlier. An inquest into her death was heard by area coroner Johanna Thompson at Norfolk Coroner's Court this week. Miss Bussey's family paid tribute via a statement to the court, describing her as a determined and caring person who valued her independence and rarely asked for help. They said, "She was an independent-minded person who would only ask for help as a last resort, and even then, reluctantly. She was always supportive of others, dealing with sadness and hardships in their lives." Mrs. Bussey, a retired administrator, lived with her husband Brian, a retired butcher. They did not require any additional support from carers, but had recently fitted an additional stair rail at their home. The inquest heard that in the weeks before her death, Mrs. Bussey had become increasingly confused and that her mobility had begun to deteriorate. She suffered from leg pain, fatigue, and several minor falls. Her GP, Dr. Ian Smith of Sheringham Medical Practice, said he saw Mrs. Bussey on April the 14th after relatives raised concerns about her balance and memory. He described her as an infrequent attendant who rarely sought medical help and said she had been feeling more exhausted and unsteady with worsening short-term memory over the previous 2 months. Dr. Smith said her most recent fall had been on April the 9th after attending the surgery for a COVID vaccination. He arranged for her to have further tests, but these had not taken place before her death. On the evening of April the 17th, Mrs. Bussey's husband heard a loud bang before he found her lying at the bottom of the stairs with her head against the front door. Her shoes were found a few steps up the staircase. She was conscious but confused, and her family helped her to the sofa, where she began drifting in and out of consciousness before an ambulance was called. She was taken to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, where scans showed a severe head injury, including a skull fracture and a traumatic intracerebral hemorrhage. Consultant physician Dr. James Edwards told the inquest that the injury was invariably fatal without very invasive and risky surgical intervention. Her scan results were reviewed by the neurological team at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, who agreed that surgery would not have saved her life. Mrs. Bussey was placed on end-of-life care and died 2 days later on the evening of April the 19th. The medical cause of death was given as a traumatic subdural and extradural hemorrhage due to an unwitnessed fall down the stairs. In their statement, the family added they wished they had recognised that her earlier symptoms might have been linked to a brain bleed. They said her eldest sister was diagnosed with dementia at a younger age, and we incorrectly thought her symptoms also indicated dementia. Recording a conclusion of accident, Miss Thompson expressed her sympathy to the family. Born in Sheringham on September the 21st, 1940, Mrs. Bussey was well known in the town and will be remembered fondly by many friends and neighbours who have shared their condolences with her family.
Carly Harper, who has served as the Cabinet Member for Finance at City Hall has been named as the party's candidate for the mayoralship, which will be created as part of a $1 billion devolution deal. Miss Harper has been chosen by members following hustings across both counties, with an election due to take place next year to decide who will take on the new role. The mayor will oversee major projects in both counties, such as transport, housing and infrastructure, similar to other figureheads in places such as Manchester and Liverpool. At this time, the Conservatives have announced Tim Passmore, Suffolk Police and Crime Commissioner, as their candidate for mayor. Caroline Topping, leader of East Suffolk Council, is the Green Party's choice. The Lib Dems have announced five hopefuls for the role, but have yet to select their mayoral candidate. Reform is yet to announce its candidate. Miss Harper, who represents Lakin and Ward at Norwich City Council, said, "I'm honoured to have been confirmed as Labour's candidate for the Norfolk and Suffolk mayoral election. I want to thank Labour members across East Anglia for putting their trust in me. It's time to deliver the change and renewal Norfolk and Suffolk deserves, tackling the issues that matter most to local people, from health and the cost of living to better transport links and affordable housing. My priority now is to listen to residents across our region, hear about their views and earn their trust ahead of polling day. Together, we can build an inclusive, ambitious future for everyone across Norfolk and Suffolk, one that draws on our region's reputation for innovation, science, clean energy, and creative arts to create opportunity, raise living standards, and make sure no community is left behind. I'm excited to work alongside our brilliant Labour MPs, councillors, and members over the coming months to share a message of hope and ambition, and to show how, together, we can unlock the full potential of our region and build a better future for all who call it home."
Campbell and Sheila Welsh, 82 and 81, from Holt, died on December the 22nd last year after being struck by a car on the A148 in High Kelling. More than 2,300 people have signed a petition set up by their granddaughter, Izzy Welsh, calling for safety improvements on the A148. County Hall has switched off thousands of lights across Norfolk to reduce carbon emissions and save money. And at a meeting of Norfolk County Council's Conservative-controlled cabinet, there were calls for the council to listen to the communities when concerns about a lack of street lighting are raised. Liberal Democrat County Councillor David Sayers said, "9 months on from the tragic deaths of Campbell and Sheila Welsh, an incident that has rightly prompted calls for better lighting, signage and crossings, many of my residents remain concerned that this council still only reviews street lighting after accidents occur. As the nights draw in and the risk to pedestrians and cyclists increase on dark evenings, can the cabinet member explain why loss of life seems to be the price of doing the right thing? Will he now commit to a proactive policy of keeping lights on where communities raise safety concerns before tragedy strikes again?" Graham Plant, the council's cabinet member for highways, said, "The county council takes all incidents on the highway seriously, and we were saddened to hear about the tragic deaths of Campbell and Sheila Walsh. We're unable to comment further on this specific case as we're awaiting the coroner's inquest. We assess street lighting based on highway safety need, taking into account factors such as road layout, environmental impact, and long-term costs. A man in his 50s was arrested on suspicion of causing death by careless driving following the deaths of Mr. and Mrs. Welsh. Norfolk Police said they had been released under investigation while inquiries continue."
Victoria Baker from Aylsham died at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital on November 17th last year as a result of injuries suffered in an act of self-harm. The 52-year-old had been receiving care on a ward at Helsden Hospital, the region's largest psychiatric hospital, at the time of her death. An inquest into her death was due to resume this week, with a two-week hearing scheduled to be held in the presence of a jury. During a brief hearing at Norfolk Coroner's Court on Monday, Area Coroner Joanna Thompson confirmed the inquest will resume from May 18, 2026 and is still scheduled to last for a fortnight. The coroner did not reveal the cause for the delay. Do you need support? Samaritans can be reached 24/7 on 116 123. The NHS First Response Service is available via 111 option 2.
Ross Abbs, aged 77, vanished from Milton Keynes on September the 10th, and officers think he may have driven to Haysborough. Now, a spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary has confirmed that search efforts have been stood down after 6 weeks. At this stage, there are no further lines of inquiry to pursue. However, we will always review any new information, she added. Mr. Abbs' stepson, Stephen Williams, previously spoke to this newspaper about how his family live in hope that he is going to turn up somewhere. The whole family is devastated and just feeling low, but we're all trying to rally around my mum at the moment, he said. Mr. Abbs is a carer for his wife, Wendy, who was diagnosed with a brain tumour 13 years ago and was described as being a model carer by Mr. Williams. The discovery of my mum's brain tumour rarely cut any hope of going abroad, so they decided on a Norfolk holiday, and he loved it, the 56-year-old said. He was very supportive of me, and I always thought of him as my second dad. He is a great stepfather and a great grandfather to my children. The way he invests time in young people and helps them is admirable. I just really hope someone comes forward with some information about him. Mr. Abbs is described as being 5 feet 11 inches tall and of large build. He was last seen wearing black jogging bottoms with white stripes down the sides. Anyone who has seen him or may know of his whereabouts should contact Norfolk Constabulary on 101, quoting reference 177 of September the 11th.
East Runton Butchery first opens its doors in the 1950s, but closed in 2023 after the retirement of its long-standing owner, Brian Hoggett. Now, 2 years on, 39-year-old Michael Bale, who learned the trade under one of the original founders, is preparing to restore it to its former glory. It's a real full-circle moment, Mr. Bale said. When I first started my butchery career, I was trained by a man called Steve Taylor, who's now a friend of mine and helped start the original East Runton Butchery. Mr. Bale, who grew up in Cromer, has spent 2 decades working in and around the industry. His wife, daughter, parents and in-laws are all expected to be involved in some capacity at the shop, located on the East Runton High Street. He gave a special thanks to the building's owners, Richard Brownsill and Jenny Dye, who pledged to only sell the building if it would reopen as a butcher's. The shop will serve as a traditional butchery, selling the usual, pork, beef, lamb and chicken, as well as seasonal produce such as duck, venison and pheasant, all sourced as locally as possible. At a time when many high street businesses are faltering, Mr. Bale said he hopes to bring back the village butcher. It's a dying breed, he said. It's good to carry on the tradition and the skill, because if we don't, it will disappear. The average age of a butcher now is around 60, so I'm coming in as one of the younger ones. It is the first business Mr. Bale has owned, and he hopes the coastal community will rally round the shop as they did in years past. He added, "I can't wait to open the doors and bring quality, locally sourced meat and friendly personal service back to the community." It will open its doors at 8 a.m. next Thursday.
The scheme earmarked for land north of Valley Lane in Holt has proved controversial, with dozens of objectors writing to North Norfolk District Council over fears it will harm wildlife. Developer Barefield Homes wants to build 23 homes on the parcel of land, and a revised proposal has been submitted to the council this month. The changes include cutting the number of affordable homes from 8 to just 4, after a fresh assessment found building would make the entire project unviable. A flurry of new objections have been submitted to NNDC in recent weeks, including from an Oxford Brookes academic, Tim Shreves, who is the Emeritus Professor for Conservation Ecology. He has criticised the proposals for failing to deliver biodiversity net gain, calling the calculation submitted by the developer erroneous. He also worries plans to relocate slow worms living on the site will not succeed. The site is close to Spout Common County Wildlife Site and near the Glavan Valley Conservation Area, which has added to the concerns of locals. However, despite the growing backlash, Holt Town Council has offered its support for the scheme in return for a new patch of green space. Councillors say since the land has already been earmarked for housing in NNDC's Emerging Local Plan, a key document that sets out where homes can be built, they do not have an issue. In return for the housing going forward, HTC would be offered an adjoining field, which they say will be opened up to the public. NNDC is yet to make a decision on the scheme, which will be made by either officers or a committee of councillors.
Plans to turn a field into a new car park for an upmarket hotel have sparked anger in a coastal village plagued by parking problems. Chestnut Group, which owns the Maltings at Weybourne near Sheringham, has applied to use a field behind the property for extra parking. It says in a planning statement, "Parking for the residents of Weybourne, or rather the lack of sufficient parking generally in the centre of the village, has become a very vocal issue and caused much consternation. Neighbours have objected over the loss of coastal views and the impact covering grassland with gravel would have on wildlife. A car park on this site would have a negative impact on the view and character of the village from the coastal path," said one. "An area of parked cars would completely change this aspect of the village, detracting from its distinctive character and historical value." One neighbour added, "Swallows, swifts and martins return to nest in the adjacent buildings and cliff faces every year. They feed from the insects in the sky above this field that thrive because it's an undisturbed fallow field which has been allowed to generate sufficient plants that attract them." Another said the field was home to brown hares along with rare corn buntings. The council's conservation officer said, "The prospect of vehicular clutter being readily visible from the north is in no way appealing." Chestnut said the car park would be restricted to its guests and only used during peak summer periods. The statement adds, "It is well aware of the concerns and agitation that parking has caused within the village and hopes the extra parking would help diffuse this situation. A decision is expected from North Norfolk Council later this year."
Locals in Reefham claim that developers have been allowed to push through a key planning discharge, a step required before construction can begin, for a 141-home development off Broomhill Lane. They say the decision permits the removal of mature trees and hedgerows as part of road widening works, despite their belief that the foliage sits on private land. The ownership, they add, was confirmed by a Norfolk County Council representative during a meeting in May. Mark Bridges, who lives on Broomhill Lane, described the move as just another example of the council being incompetent. He said, "Reefham is a unique, landlocked, small market town with difficult communications and a lack of amenities. They plonked this allocated site here and railroaded it through planning. There has been no due process. There is no democracy in the planning system. They claim they consult people, but the number of objections was overwhelming. I pay for the local council to do their job properly, and this smacks of them either not caring or sheer incompetence." He even threatened to call the police if work went ahead as planned on Monday. Locals believe the developers, Lovell Limited, are hurrying to complete the works before a 3-year planning deadline expires in December. The site borders Reefham High School, and locals suspect the upcoming half-term offers one of the last opportunities to carry out the works before that date. The activity forms part of a wider maintenance scheme, which includes the widening of Broomhill Lane, revisions to its junction with Whitwell Road, and surfacing of a footpath to Park Lane. Among the trees under threat are two oaks believed to be about 150 years old and a 25-foot apple tree. A number of objections have been lodged on Broadland's planning portal. One complainant said that to ignore neighbour input even at this stage is, in my view, irresponsible, and that common sense must prevail in delivering the best for the region we all live in. Another described ambitions as bloody-mindedness and that the council's determination to approve the plans favours the developers. While the council did not offer a response, it clarified that it does not have permission to override ownership rights and that it is the developers' responsibility to ensure they have regard to other properties' land. In an email to locals, it said that it is not expedient for the council to seek to pursue the matter formally via its enforcement powers, and that it reserves the ability to reconsider its position in the future should it be necessary. A Lovell spokesman said, "The plans are approved by the local planning authority, and we have worked closely with Norfolk County Council, who have undertaken the design to ensure works are restricted to highway-owned assets."
Gray's traditional fish and chip shop in Norwich Road, Hofton, was the subject of an early morning blaze on Saturday. A spokesman for the Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service said crews were called to the building at around 4 a.m. Crews from Wroxham, Sprowston and Carrow attended and used hose reel jets to extinguish the blaze at the business. In a statement on its social media page, the fish shop said, "Unfortunately, on Saturday morning, we were notified of a fire within our building, which was attended to. This being said, we will be closed until further notice due to some damage in our restaurant area. We hope to be back as soon as possible. We are especially sorry to our regular customers at this time." The fire was eventually put out by around 4:38 a.m. on Saturday.
Nippy Chippy on the Broads in Potterhyam closed after a small fire last week. In a statement shared to social media, management wrote, "I'm so very grateful to all who helped. Sorry for any inconvenience." They also confirmed nobody had been injured. The chip shop opened as planned for evening service on Tuesday, October the 21st. The team said, "After last week's small fire, we've worked hard to repair the damage, make sure everything is safe, and get the shop looking its best again. Everything is now back to normal, and we can't wait to welcome you all back for your favourite fish and chips."
Bill Penman was at the helm of the Crayford and Abbs petrol station in Munsley for 25 years. The business has been sold to Johnny Sri Krishna after Mr. Penman decided to retire, with Christie and Co. managing the sale. "It has been an honour to serve the wonderful community of Munsley over the years," he said. "I would like to thank all our loyal customers and local residents for their support and friendship throughout my time at Crayford and Abbs. It has been a truly rewarding experience." Mr. Sri Krishna will continue to use the site as a forecourt while adding a convenience store offering. "I would like to thank Mr. Penman, and I'm excited to take on this challenge and build upon the established site," he added. "We are looking forward to getting started on the redevelopment of the site and bringing back the customer experience the local community deserves. I look forward to meeting our customers soon."
Sir John Fenn's own annotated volumes and manuscript notes, used in his landmark 18th century editions on the letter, had remained with his descendants since the 1780s. And now the collection has gone under the hammer for the first time, selling for £8,400 at Keys Auctioneers in Aylsham. Bosses at Keys said the sale attracted great interest, and it is believed it may have been acquired by an academic institute. It was Mr. Fenn's publication of the 15th century letters in 1787 which brought the Paston family to the public eye. They were an upwardly mobile Norfolk family who were often communicating by distance between their homes in Norwich, the Norfolk countryside, and London. When the family died out in the 18th century, antiquarians sifted through their estate, rescuing more than 1,000 letters and documents that Mr. Fenn would later edit and bring to publication. They provide a vivid glimpse of everyday life in medieval England and have given historians a unique insight into the realities for gentry during events such as the War of the Roses. Editions had sold at auction before, but this is the first time a version went to market featuring Fenn's annotations and other original material. You are listening to edition number 1991 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 31st of October 2025. Still to come, there are items about local planning matters, community stories, and, of course, the Mardler magazine section. But first, here are some articles to encourage and entice your attendance at local events and establishments.
Classic Ibiza is a touring outdoor music event that will be back at the National Trust Blickling Estate near Aylsham on Saturday, August the 1st, 2026. It is an open-air celebration of White Isle-inspired house music, reinvented by a 32-piece urban soul orchestra. Next year will be the 11th time the touring party returns to Blickling, with nearly 100,000 people enjoying Classic Ibiza events around the country in 2025. General admission costs £57.50, with children aged between 5 and 12 charged at £30 per ticket, free for under 5s, but tickets in advance still needed. Pre-sale began on Monday, October the 27th at 10 a.m, with the general release taking place on October the 28th from 10 a.m.
Erpingham Leisure Hub, based in Erpingham with Calthorpe, marked its 10th anniversary on October the 8th, having supported community-based leisure activities for residents and visitors of all ages and abilities. Diane Snelling, a committee member, said one of our walking groups has walked the equivalent of London to Cairo, 2,600 miles, and total mileage by individual walkers added together equates to almost the circumference of the Earth, 25,000 miles. The programme aims to promote affordable and inclusive physical and mental well-being through the community activities. Bill Gorham, chairman of Erpingham Leisure Hub, said our walking football sessions are primarily all about fun, participation and social interaction, regardless of age, gender or ability. That said, those members who relish the more competitive aspect of our sport have enjoyed some successes over the years.
Trebles has launched in Laundrylake, North Walsham. Founder Sam Clark said, "The inspiration behind Trebles was a desire to create a relaxed, family-friendly environment for people to come and play darts. Many youngsters are hoping to follow in their darts idols' footsteps, but often feel unwelcome in the traditional pub setting. So we have brought a new venue for kids, adults, families and friends to enjoy. There is also a store which is branded as a darts one-stop shop. The space has been designed with socialising in mind. Soft drinks and snacks are available to buy, and the team is in the process of applying for an alcohol licence to host events."
The Times listed 21 of the most eccentric stays in Norfolk, with the Clye Windmill in Norfolk making the grade. Themed rooms for guests to stay in, such as the River Room, Stone Room and Wheel Room, won its place in the list. The paper wrote, "Norfolk is, as we all know, very flat, so you don't need to go too high up to get a good view. This old windmill near Clye next the sea obliges handsomely. Added quirk factor, the mill once belonged to James Blunt's family. His room was the Stone Room, apparently." The article added that the hotel was the best on the list for walkers and beachcombers.
Helen Richardson runs Dolly's Home and Gifts, which launched in Vicarage Street, North Walsham, last December. But Mrs. Richardson soon found herself outgrowing her original space. In September, she secured a bigger shop right in the town's marketplace, and after completing a refurb, she welcomed her first customers through the door on Thursday. The new Dollies will continue to sell items from a range of brands, including Lisa Angel and Orchard Toys. But people also notice some new additions, such as her daughter's floristry business, Blooms by Dollies, which is based upstairs. Mrs. Richardson said, "Despite the weather, we had a super opening day, with lots of lovely customers, old and new, popping by." The business owner added that she is excited to be a part of the up-and-coming town of North Walsham, where several independent businesses have opened in recent months. A new darts venue called Trebles launched in Laundrylake last month. It has 10 lanes, auto-scoring systems and an in-store shop. Candy K creates a brand which sells all kinds of quirky homeware, gifts and fashion. Recently opened a pop-up shop in Mitre Tavern Yard. In August, a tattoo shop called Catharsis Inc. opened in King's Arms Street, and Wherry Arts and Crafts launched in the marketplace.
The nuclear bunker at RAF Nettieshead near Horning was first used by the military in September 1941 and will reopen during Remembrance Week for an exhibition called Searching for Home, which has been curated by Anya Vero. Schoolchildren, veterans and serving members of the armed forces are being invited between November the 12th and 14th to learn more about the bunker and contribute to the artwork. In February 1966, a fire broke out in the bunker and some doors were welded shut, leading to it being closed from 1975 to 1980. After restoration work, the bunker was used again from 1985 until it was closed around 30 years ago. The exhibition explores the theme of belonging, home and its meaning in the modern world. Being the mother of a British child, and myself being an Oxford and LSE graduate born in Latvia with half Ukrainian and half Russian heritage, has made me really reflect on what home truly means, Mrs. Vero said. Members of the public can visit the exhibition on November the 14th between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. with other days reserved for invited groups and schools. Former North Norfolk MP Duncan Baker added, "The Cold War bunker at RAF Nettishead stands as a reminder of the bravery, vigilance and sacrifice that kept our country safe for generations."
Hay Fever by Noel Coward will be performed by the Sheringham Little Theatre Players from Wednesday, November 12th to Saturday, November 15th at Sheringham Little Theatre. Set in the 1920s, the comedy follows the eccentric Bliss family as they invite four unsuspecting guests to their country home for a weekend that quickly descends into theatrical chaos and confusion. Hazel Martin, director of the Sheringham Little Theatre Players, said, "It was written and set in the 1920s, but it is still so funny because of the interactions of the characters and Coward's witty writing." The production will raise funds towards the theatre's appeal to replace the damaged screen. Hay Fever runs nightly at 7:30 p.m, with a 2:30 p.m. matinee on Saturday, November 15th. Tickets start at £13.50 and are available from sheringhamlittletheatre.com or the box office on 01263 822 347. We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear about the origins of Halloween, learn that steam power still has a place in the modern age, ponder the ticking of time, and listen to a little poetry. But first, we hear from Clive with his regular music contribution.
Welcome, listeners, to this, the last broadcast of My Music for You in 2025. Where has this year gone? My choices this month need to capture the season of fireworks and the advent of Christmas, and overall, an autumnal feel. First up, then, not the more obvious choice of Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks, but, to my mind, an equally explosive piece by Felix Mendelssohn, his War March of the Priests, from his incidental music for the play by Jean Racine. This was composed in 1844. Queen Athalia was a queen of Judah, known for her wicked rule. She was the daughter of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel of Israel, born in Samaria in 898 BC. Her husband was a descendant of King David. Mendelssohn's music was commissioned by Prussian King Frederick William IV, and the war march is often performed as a standalone concert piece by a variety of instrumental forces, both orchestral and solo instruments, notably the organ. Both the overture and the war march were written during one of Mendelssohn's visits to London. The incidental music was published in 1849, shortly after Mendelssohn's death. From Mendelssohn, we move on to Elgar and his cello concerto, which many consider to have an autumnal feel to it. It is forever associated with the late Jacqueline Dupré and her husband Daniel Barenboim, and, to my mind, theirs is the definitive recording. The concerto is considered the apogee of the solo cello repertoire, and its somewhat sombre feel is probably because it was composed in the aftermath of World War I, when Elgar's music had already become out of fashion with the concert-going public. For the most part, the concerto is contemplative. The first abridged recording was made in 1920. Not until 1928 was it recorded in its entirety. The main theme of the first movement Elgar considered as his tune, and is reported to have said, "If you ever hear someone whistling this melody around the Malvern Hills, that will be me." It is a relatively small step from Elgar to Ralph Vaughan Williams, both of them key influences in the revival of English music in the early 20th century. The one informed by the European late Romantics, and the other by the more pastoral sounds of English folk music. Vaughan Williams' Fantasia on Greensleeves is based on an English folk song, My Lady Greensleeves, which first appeared in September 1580. I've chosen it because the familiar tune of Greensleeves is the tune used for the classic Christmas carol, What Child Is This? It will hopefully get us in the mood for Christmas itself, if a little early. As a counterbalance to our early Christmas music, my last choice is the church cantata Wachet auf, more commonly known as the Sleepers Awake cantata. It is very much a piece for Advent, the four Sundays before Christmas Day, starting on 29th of November this year. First performed on the 25th of November in 1731 in Leipzig, on the 27th Sunday after Trinity Sunday. It is regarded as one of Bach's most mature and popular sacred cantatas. The whole work is worth a listen, but for me, the love duet between soprano and bass soloists, My Friend Is Mine, holds particularly fond memories. No doubt many of you will be familiar with some of the principal melodies, not least the hymn tune bass of the fourth movement, Zion Hears the Watchman Singing. I hope you will enjoy all my choices this month. Thank you so much for listening throughout the year. I hope you may have a happy and blessed Christmas and look forward to being back with you in January 2026.
Let's begin with an article written by the Artificial Intelligence Programme, Gemini, in response to the question, tell me about the history of Halloween. Halloween is a holiday with a rich and layered history, evolving from ancient pagan rituals to its modern-day iteration of costumes, treats, and community events. Its story is a tapestry woven from Celtic tradition, Roman influences, and the lasting impact of Christianity, all culminating in the festive October celebration we know today. The earliest known roots of Halloween lie in the ancient Celtic festival of Samhain, celebrated over 2,000 years ago in Ireland, the United Kingdom, and northern France. The Celts mark November the 1st as the end of summer and the beginning of the dark, cold winter, a time of year often associated with death. They believe that on the night before the new year, the boundary between the worlds of the living and the dead became blurred. Ghosts of the dead were thought to return to earth along with other supernatural creatures, like witches, fairies, and demons. To ward off these unwelcome spirits, people would light bonfires and wear costumes, often made of animal heads and skins. Food and drink were also left outside homes to appease the wandering spirits. The festival was also a time for divination, with the Celts believing it was a perfect time for priests or druids to predict the future. By the 1st century AD, the Romans had conquered most of the Celtic lands. Over the course of their 400-year rule, two Roman festivals were combined with the traditional Celtic Samhain. The first was Ferelia, a day in late October when the Romans honoured their dead. The second was a festival honouring Pomona, the goddess of fruit and trees. This association with Pomona is likely where the tradition of bobbing for apples originated. Later, as Christianity spread, the church sought to replace pagan holidays with its own observances. In the 8th century, Pope Gregory III designated November the 1st as All Saints' Day or All Hallows' Day, a time to honour Christian saints and martyrs. This was celebrated in a similar manner to Soham, with bonfires, parades and dressing up, now as saints, angels and devils. The evening before All Saints' Day became known as All Hallows' Eve and eventually Halloween. The tradition of souling also became popular around this time. Poor people and children would go door to door on All Souls' Day, November the 2nd, offering prayers for the deceased in exchange for the soul cakes, a type of sweet pastry. This practice is a clear precursor to modern trick or treating. In the 19th century, waves of Irish immigrants, particularly following the Great Irish Famine, brought their Halloween traditions to North America. These traditions merged with existing North American harvest festivals, leading to the development of unique Halloween customs. The modern jack-o'-lantern comes directly from Irish folklore about a character named Stingy Jack. The story tells of a man who repeatedly tricked the devil and after his death was denied entry into both heaven and hell. Jack was sent off into the eternal darkness with only a burning coal to light his way. He placed the coal inside a carved out turnip, and the Irish began carving their own frightening faces into turnips and potatoes to ward off evil spirits. In America, they discovered that native pumpkins were far larger and easier to carve, and the iconic jack-o'-lantern was born. By the late 19th and 20th centuries in America, Halloween celebrations often devolved into acts of mischief and vandalism. As a response to this rowdy behaviour, communities and parents began to organise controlled, family-friendly events. The earlier traditions of souling and guising, going door to door in disguise and performing for treats, combined with the desire to curb pranks, leading to the rise of supervised trick or treating. From its beginnings as a spiritual festival for communing with the dead to its modern incarnation as a major commercial holiday, the history of Halloween is a fascinating journey that continues to evolve.
Next, we hear from Justin Rowlett as he investigates advances in steam power. This item was published in the BBC News Future Earth newsletter of the 26th of August 2025. Jet-powered superbikes are hardly the poster boys of the environmental movement, but bear with me on Graham Sykes' creation, because it could tell us something important about the rising to climate challenge. I stumbled upon his vehicle in a rain-soaked field at a steam fair in Masham, Yorkshire. I'd come to see vinted engines wheezing and huffing, not cutting-edge technology. But Sykes' low-slung machine was jaw-dropping. It represents a $150,000 13-year bet that the technology which powered the Industrial Revolution could outperform high-powered fuels typically used in drag bikes. Sykes says his bike can accelerate from 0 to 60 mph in just 0.46 seconds and hit 100 mph in 0.82. He wears a neck brace and helmet restraint to prevent whiplash from the 6G force. By comparison, the Guinness World Record for the fastest acceleration by an electric car is 0.96 seconds for 0 to 60 mph. Even most rockets capable of carrying a human payload are way slower. But Sykes knew steam could deliver immense power. Back home in Beedale, North Yorkshire, he was stunned when he ran the numbers. I looked at the figures and just thought, holy smoke, he told me. When he tested a prototype in his shed, the inrush of air pulled everything off the shelves, tore off the gutters, and flung the wheelie bins across the garden. He says his bike uses an 88-litre water tank heated to 250 degrees C by a kerosene burner. This creates a pressure chamber at 40 times atmospheric pressure. A button on the handlebar releases the superheated water, which blasts out to equalise with the atmosphere. It's forced through a de Laval nozzle, as used in most rocket engines, and first developed to make steam turbines more efficient. This accelerates the water beyond the speed of sound. It's a controlled explosion in one direction, says Sykes. The water rapidly expands into condensed steam at over 1,000 mph, fast enough to create a sonic boom. Newton's third law says every action has an equal and opposite reaction, he explains. So the steam goes one way and we go the other, very quickly. But we're not pushing against air, we're pushing against condensed steam, 60 times denser. So we're carrying a wall, a reactive wall, behind us all the way. So what does this tell us about tackling climate change? The bike itself and its fuel has no particular environmental credentials, but the forces Sykes harnesses are already the backbone of much of today's low-carbon electricity generation. Steam turbines generate electricity in solar, thermal, geothermal and nuclear plants. Geothermal energy works by drilling deep underground to find naturally occurring reservoirs of hot water or steam. That can be brought to the surface and used to power turbines or provide heat, as happens at the Eden project. The UK's geology means there aren't many viable geothermal sites using current technology. But the process is low carbon and, according to Durham University's Professor John Gluyas, safe, secure and sustainable. What got me excited about Sykes' bike is that it shows mechanical and thermodynamic ingenuity still matters. In the climate fight, his mindset of repurposing, reimagining and rediscovering can be just as powerful as inventing something new. And it also reminds us that innovation doesn't always come from high-tech labs or billion-dollar research centres. Sometimes it starts with a single-minded individual in a garden shed.
Next, we hear from Russell Lyon as he reflects on the clock-making history of King's Lynn. This item was published in the Town and Around magazine of June 2025. I first took a real interest in clockmaking when I discovered that my grandfather, five times back, made long case clocks in the 1780s. Time had always been important to me in my professional life. I always seemed to be rushing between appointments, relying on a cheap plastic wristwatch to keep me going. Now, with more spare time on my hands, literally, I find myself fascinated by the history of clockmaking. Recording time has always been important to people, whether you were a Neolithic farmer recording the seasons at Stonehenge, or people in coastal communities such as in King's Lynn, where a moon phase clock helped to record the tides. Mechanical clocks were invented around 1280, and the first was recorded in 1283 at Dunstable Priory. It was the result of a collaboration between a monk and a blacksmith. The clock was used to mark the time of monastic services. At a Guildhall meeting in King's Lynn in 1373, a fine was recorded for being late after Le Clock struck 10 of the clock of St Margaret's. This means there was a striking clock in King's Lynn within 100 years of the original invention of the clock mechanism. Lantern clocks became quite common in the 17th century. They got that name not from their mechanism, but because they were usually hung from a wall like a lantern. They worked for about 30 hours before needing the rewinding of the weights which drove the mechanism. These clocks normally recorded the hours only. Thomas Tew, 1613 to 1710, was a gunsmith and clockmaker living in King's Lynn who made lantern clocks, many of which were signed and dated. He must have made a lot of them with help from his apprentices, as he lived until he was 97. It is said he retired when he was 85. Although Tew made very many clocks, he is still best remembered for the moon clock on St Margaret's Church Tower, which he made and freely gave to the town in 1681. It still stands proud, if a bit dishevelled by the weather, at 82 feet on the southwest wall of the tower. It was placed there to be easily visible from the port and River Ouse and gratefully used by sailors and merchants who relied on the tides. It was made at his own expense and charge, but he could afford it as he died a fairly wealthy man with many properties. The moon clock was not his design, but he worked from various drawings and a book called Cosmographia, probably of German origin. It shows the moon phases and ages. The copper disc rotates once each lunar month, approximately every 29 and a half days. A pointer in the shape of a dragon was attached to the rim, and as it moved around, it showed the days of the lunar month. It also shows, on the outer ring, the 24 hours of the day to indicate the time. In the great storm of 1741, much of the clock was damaged and only the outer ring survived. The clock was repaired and repainted and the engraved lines regilded. The present clock, which now stands proudly on the other tower to the moon clock, was made by John Moore and Sons of Clerkenwell, North London, in 1845. It had a fine mechanical movement but was unfortunately altered to an electric drive in the 1960s. Clockmaking changed over the years, and in many small towns, clockmakers found it easier and cheaper to import different parts of the clock, such as the dial, the mechanical movement, and even the case. It became the modern way of manufacturing. But as Geoffrey Chaucer many centuries ago so aptly said, "Time and tide wait for no man." I'm sure Thomas Tew would be thrilled that even part of his moon clock still survives into the 21st century.
As we are recording this edition on All Hallows' Eve, let's finish with an extract from Edgar Allan Poe's chilling poem, The Raven. Just the first seven stanzas. We will leave the rest to your imagination. Once, upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. "Only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my box surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here for evermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor in treating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, nothing more. Presently, my soul grew stronger. Hesitating then no longer, "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore. But the fact is, I was napping. And so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came napping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarcely was sure I heard you." Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. "Surely," said I, "surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore." "'Tis the wind, and nothing more." Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles includes community and planning matters.
The Care Quality Commission, CQC, rated the leadership at Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust, NSFT, as requiring improvement. Recognised progress had been made. The inspectors who scrutinised two of the Trust's frontline service groups said there had been an improvement in cultural overall, but they remain concerned community teams did not always ensure medicines and treatments were safe. They also said there were significant delays in completing patient safety investigations. Many staff reported that senior leaders were not visible, while employees continued to raise concerns about racial and disability discrimination at work. But inspectors were impressed by passionate, hard-working staff and said recent board appointments had brought much-needed stability. Stuart Dunn, CQC Deputy Director of Operations in the East of England, said, "We found leaders had started to make significant progress in areas. However, more is needed to ensure improvements are embedded and delivered consistently. We continue to hear about some poor experiences of workplace culture, including issues around discrimination and feeling unable to speak up. Trust leaders were aware and were taking action in response. Caroline Donovan, Chief Executive Officer at NSFT, said, "We know we still have much more to do to deliver consistent, good quality mental health services. We are particularly pleased the inspectors have once again recognised the hard work and dedication of our staff. Improving our culture is one of our strategic priorities." Zoe Billingham, NST chairman, said the trust had scored 59% overall, which put it on the cusp of a good rating. Since its inception in January 2012, the organisation has been rated inadequate 4 times. But in February, it was lifted out of special measures for the first time in 7 years. And in August, the CQC rated community services as good and highlighted some improvement in crisis care. The latest inspection was carried out in May.
In mental health, the past year saw 26,627 appointments with the Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust missed, a year-on-year increase of 125%. The figure has sparked questions over whether the Trust could do more to remind patients of when their appointments are, particularly when they have waited a long time for them. It has previously faced fierce criticism over the breakdowns in communication with the people needing its care. The organisation, which was last week urged to make improvements to the way it's run, has introduced new measures to try and mitigate the issue, including making use of technology. But new statistics have estimated that since 2019, no-shows for scheduled appointments have cost the Trust $13 million. The figures were revealed in research carried out by an organisation called Essendex, which asked NHS trusts nationwide about their missed appointments. And the research showed that just 2 trusts nationwide saw a bigger year-on-year spike between 2023 and 2024 than the NSFT. The figures the Trust supplied Essendex showed 11,783 missed appointments in 2023, compared with 26,627 in 2024. However, the organisation has since questioned its own FOI response, providing this newspaper with different figures, stating 21,371 were missed in 2023 and 22,156 in 2023. A spokesman said the disparity in the figures was due to the Trust applying different criteria for interpretation of a scheduled appointment. Stuart G, the Chief Transformation Officer at NSFT, said, "We're working hard to reduce missed appointments through improved patient engagement and smarter use of technology. I would also like to take this opportunity to encourage people who are unable to make their scheduled appointment to let us know as soon as possible, so we can reallocate the appointment to someone else who needs it."
A private mental health hospital has dismissed rumours it is about to close and be turned into asylum seeker housing. Southern Hills, which operates near Munsley on the North Norfolk coast, has become the focus of speculation in recent weeks that it could shut. It follows the site, which is used by the NHS, becoming the focus of concern after staff warned it was cutting the number of beds it offers, and several employees were told their jobs are at risk earlier this year. The uncertainty led to people living in the area questioning its future as a hospital, sparking rumours it could be used to house asylum seekers. Sites such as hospitals and care homes, which may have closed, often become the focus of debate over their use for housing asylum seekers due to the Home Office's efforts to find alternative accommodation rather than using expensive hotels. but the hospital's management has dismissed these rumours after County Councillor for Munsley, Ed Maxfield, called for more transparency from Southern Hills. In response, Hospital Director Vicky Hare gave reassurances about the future of the site. She said, "I would like to reassure you and the local community that there are currently no plans to close the hospital or alter its use." While the hospital says it has no plans to shut, the hospital director acknowledged it is experiencing lower occupancy levels. The speculation about the future use of Southern Hills comes at a time when the Home Office is under intense scrutiny for its use of hotels to house asylum seekers. A report by a committee of MPs has found officials have squandered billions of pounds due to its policies on asylum accommodation. The Home Affairs Committee said the department was struggling to cope with a surge in demand for asylum housing and said flawed contracts and incompetent delivery had added to these issues.
Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service received 273 calls for carbon monoxide incidents in 2024-2025, compared to just 80 in 2020. This is a 241% increase in the number of reports received in the county, according to the findings from a Freedom of Information request. Carbon monoxide is known as the silent killer, as the gas that has no smell or taste, but poisoning can be fatal. Around 50 people die from carbon monoxide poisoning every year in the UK, with thousands more needing hospital treatment. The gas is produced when fuel doesn't burn properly and can often escape from faulty or poorly maintained appliances, such as gas or oil boilers, cookers, and wood burners. Symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning include dizziness, headaches, nausea, and flu-like symptoms. While call-outs have increased significantly, Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service said the majority of the incidents were false alarms. Of the 273 calls last year, fire crews only attended 34 incidents. Head of Prevention and Protection, Emir Koff, said, "We always encourage people to call 999 if they suspect a carbon monoxide leak and leave the property if they can. Our firefighters carry equipment which enables swift detection of carbon monoxide, and we work with partner agencies both to educate and reduce risk, and also at incidents to ensure scenes are made safe for the public. We would encourage everyone to buy carbon monoxide detectors for their home, as this gas is odourless. They can also ensure regular servicing of fuel-burning appliances, that chimneys are swept, and maintain good ventilation in the home." The service thinks the increase in the number of calls in Norfolk for suspected carbon monoxide incidents may simply be due to more people using carbon monoxide alarms in their homes. Mr. Goff said, "We have been working in partnership with Cadent to also supply carbon monoxide alarms when we carry out our home fire safety visits to our vulnerable communities. Thanks to that, plus other agencies and homeowners now buying alarms, more people now have these in the home, enabling early detection."
Children at Stalham Infant and Junior School enjoyed a week of activities focused on science, technology, engineering, the arts and mathematics. The space-themed programme called Harvest for the Future, From Earth to Space, linked Harvest Festival with human space travel. Pupils learned about future possibilities of growing, harvesting and eating food on Earth, the Moon or Mars. A highlight of the week was a visit from Starlight Planetarium, which brought a fully immersive digital dome to the school. Children from nursery to year six explored stars, planets and galaxies and learned about space travel, astronauts and the challenges of living and even growing food in space. Glenn Russell, executive principal for Stalham Infant and Junior School, said, "At Stalham, we are committed to giving our children rich, memorable experiences that spark curiosity and deepen their understanding of the world around them." This STEAM-themed harvest week goes beyond traditional learning. It opens up exciting conversations about the future of food, sustainability and space exploration, helping our children and families imagine what life could be like for generations to come.
Stalham Infant and Junior School, part of Broad Horizons Education Trust, will be offering new places for two-year-olds from January 2026 in a setting with all the comfort of home. The Norfolk School, which currently accommodates nursery provision for 3- and 4-year-olds, has been recognised as a hygge provider. Hygge, a Danish term, depicts a warm, welcoming and comfortable environment, focusing on well-being and a sense of belonging. Glenn Russell, executive principal at Stalham Infant and Junior School, said this award reflects not only the transformation of our learning spaces, but also our belief that children need warmth, connection and a sense of home within the school. The school plans to extend this hygge environment to two-year-olds, creating a nurturing and calming space for their early education. From the beginning of 2026, these youngest members will also enjoy the benefits of a home-like atmosphere. Places will be available for two-year-olds from January 2026. And for more information, contact Nursery Manager at stalhamacademy.co.uk.
Heath Lodge Care Home in Holt, Norfolk, achieved the standards required for the Veteran Friendly Framework, VFF. The framework provides support for the practical, emotional and social needs of the armed forces community in care homes. It aims to curb loneliness and improve the health and well-being of the 25,000 veterans residing in care homes across England. The home met 8 standards to achieve veteran-friendly status, including noting armed forces status in care plans, addressing social isolation and directing residents to support services like the Royal British Legion. Hazel Madden, General Manager at Heath Lodge Care Home, said, "It's a proud moment for our home to be recognised for our commitment to our residents who have served. The most rewarding part has been seeing the positive impact firsthand. Our veteran residents are forming new friendship groups, sharing stories, and there's a real renewed sense of camaraderie. It's about honouring their service in a way that truly enriches their lives every day." Catherine Glass, VFF project lead at Royal Star and Garter, said, "We're delighted that Heath Lodge Care Home achieved VFF status."
On Saturday, October the 11th, the Cromer Ladies Lifeboat Guild and supporters commemorated the anniversary of the first RNLI Street Collection, held in Manchester on October the 11th, 1891. Volunteers, dressed in period costume, joined the town centre fundraising, which raised more than £570, while the coffee morning contributed a further £600. Liz Holehouse, chair of the Guild, said, "These events wouldn't be possible without the tireless commitment of our volunteers and the generosity of the community. Every pound raised helps ensure we can continue our life-saving work."
Our last few articles cover the impact of a dry summer and then heavy storms, the generous legacy wheeled onto Clyde Marshes, and account of the dangerous animals living in Norfolk.
Anglian Water said September was the first month since January to have above average rainfall. 10 out of the last 12 have seen lower than average levels, leaving reservoirs, rivers and groundwater lower than normal for this time of the year, with much more rainfall needed to replenish them. As well as the second driest summer since the drought of 1976, 2025 also saw the warmest summer on record, with a mean temperature of 16.1 centigrade between June the 1st and August the 31st, which is 1.51 centigrade above the long-term average. Ian Rule, AW's Director of Water Services, said, "As we head into autumn and winter, we're likely to see some more rain, so it's easy to forget what a dry year we've had so far. In fact, this spring and summer period was the driest since 1976. Despite some recent rainfall, though, our modelling suggests that for water resources to return to normal levels, we will need a significant amount of consistent rainfall this winter, more than 100% of the usual rainfall every month until next April." Mr. Rule said that meant the region needed more rainfall over the next 6 months than it has had across the whole of 2025 so far. AW is asking customers to use a little less water whenever they can to safeguard supplies for next year. Amid the second worst drought since records began, the region's farmers suffered their second worst harvest on record. Yields of key crops like wheat and barley plummeted, as the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit warned, "This is what farming in climate change looks like."
Storms Amy and Benjamin pushed high levels of salt water into the rivers Ant, Bure and Thurne in October. A sudden rise in saline levels can be fatal to wildlife because it can cause osmotic stress and dehydration, and this has led to hundreds of dead fish being spotted along the Broads. An Environment Agency spokesman has now confirmed staff have recovered 75,000 fish to safe waters. Fisheries officers have rescued more than 75,000 fish on the Norfolk Broads after water quality on three rivers was reduced by a naturally occurring change in conditions, he said. High tides caused by recent storms pushed salt water into the rivers Ant, Bure and Thurne. "We have raised the fish barrier at Potterheim Boatyard to help reduce the impact of saline-rich water and create a refuge for the remaining numbers. Our staff remain in the area to monitor conditions and rescue more fish as needed. Anyone spotting fish in distress is urged to call the Environment Agency's 24-hour incident hotline on 0800 807 060.
A generous legacy left by renowned wildlife artist Robert Gilmore, the Gilmore Discovery Hide has been created as part of a wider project helping the Clyde Marshes Nature Reserve and its wildlife adapt to the impacts of climate change. It replaces a popular wildlife hide previously found along the Shingle Beach that was destroyed in a storm in 2013. The new hide has been installed on wheels to protect it from the same fate and allows Norfolk Wildlife Trust, NWT, staff to tow it to safety when bad weather is forecast. In tribute to Mr. Gilmore, the hide features a series of his best-known artworks. For the last 25 years of his life, he lived and worked in Clyde, exploring and celebrating the wildlife that made a home on the North Norfolk coast through his well-known lino cut prints. In 2011, he completed lino cuts for 4 sets of postage stamps for Royal Mail, with a further 3 sets in 2012. He died in May 2022, aged 85, following a lengthy period of ill health. daughter Emily Gilmore said, "We are really delighted to see the completion of this imaginative and innovative reintroduction of the North Hyde on Clyne Marshes. It is a great honour that the NWT has chosen to name it after Robert Gilmore. Clyne Marshes was his favourite birding ground, and there couldn't be a more fitting memorial. He would have been thrilled to think of the benefit and enjoyment this wonderful addition will bring to visitors to the nature reserve. We look forward to inviting you to enjoy some of Robert's work adorning the inside of the wildlife hide, and if you take a look from the windows, you might just catch sight of one of his favourite subjects. Clye and Salthouse Marshes is one of the best-known nature reserves in the UK. Visited by bird watchers, walkers and sightseers from around the country, the site is very special thanks to the unusual variety of habitats it is home to, including salt and freshwater marsh, reed bed and saline lagoons. Across the nature reserve, 6 wildlife hides, including the new Robert Gilmore Discovery Hide, offer views across pools and scrape that the wildlife charity specially manages to attract breeding and migratory birds. Visit norfolkwildlifetrust.org.uk/Clyne Marshes for more information.
International wildlife charity Born Free found that more than 2,700 dangerous wild animals are being kept with licences in the UK and Northern Ireland. Across Norfolk, 40 wild animals are being kept privately, ranging from clouded leopards to ostriches and wild boar. The 2 clouded leopards are in Breckland, and a black and white ruffed lemur can also be found in the district. Clouded leopards have the largest canine teeth to body size proportion of any animal. A wild boar and an ostrich make up the animals being kept privately in the Broadland area, while 25 black bucks, a type of antelope, make up the privately kept animals in King's Lynn and West Norfolk. North Norfolk houses 3 tapirs and 2 camels, while South Norfolk has 2 savannah cats and 3 servals. All animals are being kept legally under the Dangerous Animals Act 1976.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!